sitting there with a bottle of Jack Daniels and a gun in one hand was just, I mean, I didn't want to do it anymore. I was over it. You know, I'm literally looking at my life. I'm like, how the hell did this happen? You know, and I'm having all these thoughts and this self-awareness moment. Like, how did I get myself into this? You know? And so family members call me, you know, and I can't do this anymore. I don't know what to do, you know, and talking with them and just thinking about what is it that I'm going to do with my life. I'm at a turning point right now. Do I just end it, or do I just find a way to overcome what I'm dealing with? I mean, in that moment, you have a choice.
That was Sean Douglas, and this is the All Things Risk Podcast. Welcome back, or welcome to the All Things Risk Podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo. I'm your host. This is my show. This is a show in which we go long form, and I use the lenses of risk, resilience, randomness, and uncertainty to get into all kinds of topics. I look at or deal with these themes in my day job. I'm a risk management professional in the corporate or organizational context, and I wanted to start a show in which I explored these things outside of all of those types of corporate or business domains. So I started this show, and we're on episode 31 now, which is amazing. I've had adventurers, athletes, journalists, academics, entrepreneurs, writers, and many other cool people. It's very satisfying, but it's also loads of hard work. It's just me. I'm the editor, the writer, the producer, the scheduler, the interviewer, and all sorts of things. I'm still learning. The show is still evolving, and I just wanted to thank you very much for being here. Regardless of where and how you listen to the show, whether you're commuting, whether you're on a train, a car, a bus right now, or running, or working out, or cooking, or shopping, or whatever, thank you. Thank you for being here. And if you enjoy the show and would like to support it, the best thing that you can do really is quite simply to subscribe. But if you wanted to go a little bit beyond that, you can give us a rating or review, particularly on iTunes. That helps a lot. Guys, 2016 is coming to an end. And for many people, that might not come soon enough. For many of us, it hasn't been the greatest of years. But on the plus side, in terms of this show, I've had the honor of sharing some great conversations with you throughout the year. So you know what? I'm thinking about doing a best of 2016 episode in which I take some of the bits and pieces of some of my favorite episodes, my favorite portions of those episodes. And if you have some certain episodes or certain parts of those conversations that stood out for you, I'd love to hear from you, and I'd love to hear what those were so that I can include them in the best of 2016. Give me a shout, drop me a note. allthingsrisk@gmail.com is probably the best place in which you can do that. But if not, you can give me a tweet at riskthings is the Twitter handle, and I'd love to hear from you. On to today's episode, and we're going to get back to a topic that we've explored through various lenses. It's resilience. So I've talked about resilience before. Resilience is really, quite simply, just the ability to bounce back from setbacks or things that either we didn't see coming or we did, but in spite of our best efforts, we weren't able to avoid. And it's very important because, you know, difficult things are just about guaranteed to happen to us. I'm sorry to break it to you, but if you had, let's say you had a set of 10 risks that you're facing with whatever it is you're trying to do, and a 10% chance that each individual risk has a 10% chance of happening, well, chances are one of those things is going to happen, probabilistically speaking. And that's just talking about the things that we can identify. There's a whole range of unknowns that we are also dealing with. But resilience is really the whole concept of being able to withstand it, actually just being able to or being comfortable in the midst of uncertainty. And as we also talk about at length in terms of this show, that uncertainty and risk can be a very healthy thing. I'm going to include a wonderful article I came across yesterday in Rolling Stone magazine about fear and why we are currently living in an age of fear, even though historically speaking, we're in the safest era that we've ever been as human beings. And it's a wonderful article. It talks about the fact that when we have agency or control of something, then it allows us to deal with that uncertainty and ambiguity much more effectively. And that's really what resilience is all about. It's about the ability to take advantage of opportunities, to withstand shocks, to bounce back, as I mentioned. And my guest today is all about that. He's all about that. I want you to meet Sean Douglas. Sean is an American, and he currently works at the United States Air Force as an operations supervisor. But he's also an author. He wrote a book called Decisions, The Power to Overcome Self-Defeating Behaviors. He's a resilience trainer, so he trains people in the art of resilience, in the practice of resilience. He's a motivational speaker, and he gets very personal with us. He shares a very raw story, a very personal story about surviving a suicide attempt, an attempt to take his own life. And really, if you think about that as the ultimate low point that we could hit when we're contemplating doing something as dire, as extreme as that, well, that in many respects turned into ultimate resilience, I think, for him, or bouncing back from that. He survived that attempt. He turned his life around. He then got on to coaching and helping others deal with similar issues. And he's done some amazing work. He became a drill sergeant in the Air Force, and he does have that sort of drill sergeant intensity when you speak to him. But he shares his story, and I'm very grateful to Sean for sharing that story. And we get into talking about how to become more resilient. We talk about decision making. We talk about self-defeating behavior. Obviously, we talk about uncertainty. And we talk about resilience in terms of mental, physical, and spiritual resilience. And when we talk about spiritual resilience, just to let you know that Sean is a devout Christian, and he does mention that. But when he talks about what he means by spiritual resilience, he means having some core values and beliefs. And I do know that my audience comes from many different faiths and cultures, just so that you're aware when we do get to that part of the discussion. Later in the program, Sean does clarify what he means by spiritual resilience. And it's a very interesting conversation. I think you're going to get a lot out of it. So, ladies and gentlemen, without any further delay, here is Sean Douglas. So, Sean, welcome to the All Things Risk Podcast. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Oh, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So, I was telling you earlier that I don't have a set of pre-programmed questions, but I've tended to start every episode with this one question, which is, when people ask you what you do, how do you respond to them?
Yeah, I'm an Air Force veteran, a inspirational speaker, a resiliency trainer teaching mental, physical, spiritual, and social resilience skill sets, and I'm also an author.
Very cool. Okay, so a little bit of I'm curious, a little bit of background. You were born in Detroit.
Yeah, is that right? Detroit, Michigan. Yep.
Oh, cool. I grew up in Windsor, Ontario, right across the river.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. What if you just tell us a little bit about your background? You got into the military, and you know, what was your path? How did, is that something that you always wanted to do, or what led you there?
Yeah, my dad was in the Air Force, mm-hmm. and he left when I was real young to pursue that. My brother-in-law was a Marine. Both of my grandfathers served in the Korean War. We've had a lot of family members in the military, but it wasn't something I was like, oh my gosh, I'm destined to do this. It was more like, I graduated high school. I really wasn't doing anything with my life. It was something that I really considered doing. I was leaning forward to doing, but after September 11th, mm-hmm. 2001, I was like, I'm so doing this. You know what I mean? It was like an extra push I needed. And so, like, not even 2 months later, I was gone. About 2 months, I was gone.
Right. And that's that was in the Air Force?
Yeah, in the Air Force, yeah.
And what was, so you became a drill sergeant. Is that right? Is that, did I get that right?
Yeah. So I started out as just a maintainer, as a crew chief, working F-15s. But a special duty assignment came up, and it's kind of a crazy story how that all happened. I basically went through a tragedy that we'll, I'm sure, talk a little bit about later on. I went through a tragedy, and my commander was like, dude, you know, you should be a drill instructor. And some of the people around me was like, man, that'd be really cool for you to be a drill instructor. It was something that I really, really wanted to do. And so I applied for it, and I got it, and I became a drill instructor. I was a drill instructor for Air Force Basic Training from 2009 to 2013.
Cool. I only know stuff from the movies, which is probably a terrible place to learn about the military, particularly the U.S. military. So when you know, you say drill sergeant, the picture that comes up in my mind is, you know, the guy from Full Metal Jacket, right?
And, not far off.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Yeah. I guess it's a little bit, is it a little bit like that? I mean, what's it like being a drill sergeant? What goes into it?
Well, so it's not like, you know, the Marine Corps or the Army where we're like, you know, kill, 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 you know, like all that, you know, but you know, a lot of people are like, oh, well, the Air Force is, you know, the chair force, because you guys are always sitting down, not doing nothing. That's very far from the truth. We just have a different mentality. You know, we're all about cyber warfare and air warfare and, you know, us grounded pound and, you know, like Marines and Army. You know, that's just not us. You know, we have those guys to take care of that. It's just a different mentality. But the mindset is always the same. We're in the military. We're serving our country, and if anybody messes with us, it's game on. I mean, that's the mindset of everybody. But as a drill instructor, we're even more hard than and intense with our trainees than some of the other branches, because we have more to prove. So we did a blue to green program where an Army drill instructor and an Air Force drill instructor basically swapped. So we had an Army guy at our base, and he's like, dude, you guys are crazy. Like, you guys are way more intense, man. Like, all you guys do is yell and throw stuff, and it's a big show. I'm like, yeah, it's a big show. That's what it is. It's, I mean, I have 8 weeks to prepare you for military basic training. It's not like, well, I have a job to do. I got to train you. But if I don't, then it's whatever. No, we didn't look at it that way. We are the best of the best that the Air Force has to offer. So as a drill instructor, we have to maintain our standards, and our standards are pretty high. So,
So the job is to prepare new recruits for basic training.
We prepare what?
You're preparing new recruits for basic training.
Yeah. So we basically, so, I mean, a lot of people are 18, 19, 20, 21 years old. Most of the preparation prior to basic training is handled by their recruiters. Well, once they get to us, that 0 week, that first day, we call it 0 week. Once we get them in, you know, it is game on. You know, screaming, yelling, you know, making lives miserable. We used to call them destroying your soul. You know, just different things. But at the end, like, it's 8 weeks of basic training. But if I'm yelling and screaming like I was back then, if I'm yelling and screaming in the fourth or fifth week of training, I am not an effective instructor. So at that point, you know, in the fourth, fifth week, I mean, you're halfway done. You're almost you're to that point where I shouldn't have to tell you stupid stuff. I shouldn't have to reiterate the points that were made back in the first week of training. So they're pretty self-sufficient right around the fifth week of training, and we're cruising. Seventh week, I'm cruising. I'm like, hey guys, do this. And that's it. I mean, they've got it by seventh week. I mean, I should never have to yell.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have to, because they get a little complacent. But marching down the road, calling out Jody's, man, that's probably the best part about it. You and your flight just marching down the road.
So I guess the idea is that you break the new recruits down to build them up, right? So
exactly.
You have kids coming in; they're 18 years old. Who knows what they've been through or what their, you know, what their perspectives on life are, and you know, that that probably isn't going to make for a very good team if you got them to do whatever it is. So I guess that can you walk us through a little bit of that sort of break someone down to build them up? What goes into all of that?
So the way we do that is we need to strip you of everything you've known. We take away all the clothes, the civilian clothes, the luggage that you came in with, basically that part of your life. We want to strip it all down and we want to build you up how we see you as a military member with our core values. You know, so in the Air Force, our core values are integrity first, service before self, and excellence in all we do. We do this by stripping you down piece by piece. We see that you have these certain habits, we're going to break you those habits. We see that you have leadership skills, we're going to build those up while tearing down everything else. So we are looking and searching for all of those negativity, those bad habits, those things that will get you killed in the field, but also things that will bring down other parts of your unit. So if we see somebody who's really lazy, we're going to do speed drills. Like, we'll make you go from one point to the other as fast as you can. Nope, you didn't do it. Okay, give me 10 push-ups. Okay, stand back up. Now do it. I mean, it's just different. We do bed drills. If they're going really, really slow on their beds, like making their beds, it's like, I give you 2 minutes per sheet. 2 minutes per sheet, go. Oh, you didn't put your sheet on in 2 minutes? Cool. Down and give me 10. All right, let's do it again. Now let's do it again. And we just keep on doing that. And then we break them of those other habits. And we build them. And something as simple as making a bed or putting a uniform on a certain way, you know, at a certain speed, conditions them for other things we're going to teach them later on in basic training. Weapon skills, you know, they go for a week. We call it the beast. So the Marines have the Crucible. The Army has Hell Week. We have something called the beast, which is basic expeditionary airman skills training. They're in the field for a week, sleeping in tents on like a mock deployment, and we throw everything at the wall at them. I mean, we're throwing blanks. We shoot off blanks at them. They have ground burst simulators that simulate mortars coming in. I mean, we're putting them through a mock deployment. They're getting bombed, they're getting shelled, they're getting screamed at. We's like, hey, you and you are dead, lay down and someone's gonna fix you, whatever. So what we do in the beginning, we break them down piece by piece and build them back up so that later on in basic training, later on in the military, they have those core values instilled in them.
It sounds, just when I hear you speak with a lot, you clearly have a lot of passion for that. And it sounds like you took to that quite a lot.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. In 2010, all the rookie instructors, you know, so you go through school, be a drill instructor, you go through school, it's like 7 weeks of school. Then you graduate and you have to push your student flight. Student flight is you with a seasoned trainer. And that that is where people will quit most times.
Okay.
Because you're pushing this flight as a drill instructor, but you're messing up. You know, calling commands on the wrong foot, not teaching them the right things, being late to appointments, and you're constantly getting screamed at by your senior drill instructor. He is like coming down like a ton of bricks on you. And that's, you push one flight like that. If you can make it past that one flight, then they will give you the keys to push through another set of flights. But if you don't, then you go back to square one, and maybe you don't become a drill instructor. Maybe, I mean, this is your certification. So they took all the rookies that year, right, and they put them through a series of tests, some PT tests, weapons tests, academic tests. You know, they put them through all kinds of drill tests, everything that we do as a drill instructor. We test on it, and I beat out 8 other drill instructors that were in my squadron, and then all of the other squadrons, like 6 other squadrons that are around in our big group. And so me versus all the other squadrons, and I beat those guys, and I was the 2010 Rookie Instructor of the Year. Oh. It was awesome.
Congratulations. So I do want to get into that story around why, you know, how you got into becoming a drill instructor and you know why your I guess commanding officer suggested that would be a good thing for you to do. I'm wondering if we could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So when I joined the Air Force, my recruiter said that, oh, you're going to be an aircraft maintainer. Well, you're going to have a drinking problem and you're going to have a lot of paperwork. Like, oh, well, whatever, you know. well, maintainers have a bad rap. You know, we're the bad boys of the Air Force, you know, the grease monkeys, we're pretty much, you know, the ones that are kind of cast off, like, oh, well, the uniform is always trashed. But we work hard and play hard. So what happened was I developed a drinking problem.
Right.
So, you know, by 26, you know, I mean, I'm full bore drinking, you know, functioning alcoholic, you know, joined the military in 2001. And by 2005, 2006, I mean, I'm full drinking every day, you know, all night long, full drinking problem. Well, I had met my wife in Utah in 2007. I had my house got set fire to. It burned down.
Wow.
When I was at a party, everybody was drinking. Everybody was drunk. My house got set on fire somehow. And, you know, I lost my house. She had kind of taken me in and was helping me out and whatnot. We just ended up getting together. So I was like, oh, well, since I'm, you know, with this girl and, I can just go back to what I was doing or whatever. So I ended up doing what I always do, drink all the time and drink my sorrows away. And there's some past childhood things that I didn't want to deal with and past hurts that I didn't want to deal with. And so we got married. And then in 2008, in December of 2008, I was losing my career because I was drunk all the time. They didn't want me to touch nothing. And she left with the kids, told me that she's done. I can't deal with this no more. And around Christmas of 2008, I actually put a gun in my mouth. Wow. And I was like, I'm done. I don't want to live this life anymore. I'm done. Can't do this. I don't want to live this life. I was raised by an alcoholic and drug consuming stepfather who abused myself and my mother. And I was turning into him. And I said, the only way to stop it is for me not to live. That's the only way I can stop it. And I thought that was the only way out because I didn't want to become what I despised. So yeah, I actually tried to take my own life in December of 2008.
Wow.
I got the help I needed. I reached out, you know, I got the help I needed. I knew I couldn't live this life anymore, but I always felt like I had a purpose. I always felt like I was the guy who wanted to invent the light bulb. I wanted to invent the car. I wanted to do something so miraculous that I wasn't famous, but that I provided value, or that I provided a purpose to somebody else's life. And without me, then this thing that I could invent or this thing that I could provide would have never been invented. So I reached out, got help. I went to an alcohol program for a couple of weeks, did that, stopped drinking. And my commander was like, man, you've made a tremendous turnaround. You should be a drill instructor. Like, I mean, this would be amazing for you. You have a powerful testimony and you should do this. I applied and I was accepted.
Wow. Well, that's amazing. An amazing story. Thank you for sharing that. Was when you said you kind of reached out for help. Obviously, you didn't go through with with committing suicide, clearly. Was there a moment? Was it a realization that you've hit bottom? Like, what was it that you know started the turnaround?
Yeah, I tell people, you know, I bounced off the rock at the bottom and hit rock bottom twice. That's how hard I fell. I mean, it was just a bad 2008, between 2007, like St. Patrick's Day 2007 and December of 2008, that was probably the worst almost 2 years of my life. Like the rest of 2007 wasn't, I mean, it was ups and downs, you know, but really 2008 was just, that was bad. That was just, that was a bad year. Sitting on my floor with a bottle of Jack Daniels, crying, you know, crying out to somebody, crying out to people, crying out to God, who at the time I didn't believe in. I was raised Catholic, but I didn't believe it. I mean, if God was there, then why am I dealing with this bad stuff? Like, why am I in the depths of my own hell? You know, you're sitting there with a bottle of Jack Daniels and a gun in one hand, it was just, I mean, I didn't want to do it anymore. I was over it. You know, I'm literally looking at my life. I'm like, how the hell did this happen? You know, and I'm having all these thoughts and this self-awareness moment. Like, how did I get myself into this? You know? And so family members call me, you know, and I can't do this anymore. I don't know what to do, you know, and talking with them and just thinking about what is it that I'm going to do with my life. I mean, I'm at a turning point right now. Do I just end it or do I just find a way to overcome what I'm dealing with? I mean, in that moment, you have a choice. And so, you know, I picked myself up. I dumped out the bottle of Jack Daniels. I think it was like a quarter bottle left, if I remember right. You know, I dumped out the bottle. You know, I threw the bottle in the trash and I sat on the couch and I'm like, what am I going to do? You know, what am I going to do? I reached out to my supervisor, kind of told him what was going on. You know, we had a meeting in the office the next morning. I'm still drunk. You know, I couldn't even sleep. You know, I started crying in the office and I can't do this. And all of their faces was like, holy crap, dude. Holy crap. And so I told them what I was dealing with and they kind of knew. But they got me the help. You know, I talked to the chaplains, which is basically a military pastor. That's pretty much what it is. Talked to them, got some help. I went through some anger management classes. I went through some other things, some other tools and tips and tricks that they were giving me. And in 2009, you know, I said, okay, this is what I want to do. You know, in 4 months, I went down there to be a drill instructor. It was a 4 month kind of a process, 4 month recovery. And I was like, man, my life was way better. I took action right away. In January, I hit it hard. February, I wasn't drinking. I was done. And for March, it was me every day. What can I do to be better? What can I do to be better every day? What can I do to be better? And then April, you know, I put in for the drill instructor job and I got it. So
That's awesome. I've heard you talk a little bit about a sense of purpose and how important that is. How much does that experience of being a suicide survivor now resonate with you in terms of, I guess, helping others? Because you're a coach, you're a trainer, you're many things.
Yeah. That experience, that's somewhere I don't want to go back to.
Yeah.
And every time I think that my life sucks, all I have to do is look back and go, no, not so much. You know what I mean? I've met people on my journey in speaking and training. I've met people that almost my story mirrors them. They were an alcoholic. They were abused. They were abusing people. You know, they were not the nice version of themselves. So what I've learned is that I have a story, but it's not all my story. There's other people that have almost the same story. There's other people that have had the same feelings as me. One takeaway of that is not to get caught up in I'm the only one, because I guarantee you are not the only one who has ever experienced that feeling, you know? And a lot of times, you know, we curse God and we talk about, well, you know, he wouldn't let me What you have to remember is that God knows what he's doing. And I can't say that my adversity is the worst thing that's ever happened to me. Not using my adversity to my advantage and not finding purpose in my adversity would be the tragedy. That would be the bad thing.
Right.
You know, in 2014, my wife and I gave our lives to Christ. So one of the thing was, and I learned that I can't talk to God and say, God, guess what just happened to me today? Because he's not going to go, oh my gosh, really? Like, he already knows, you know? So that's one of the things that ever since we came to Christ, we tell our story. We host life groups at our house and we have couples that come in. It was like, I know where you're at. We were there. I know how you're feeling because I was there. When I talk about my story and my testimony and I tell other people, they come up to me and say, dude, that was me a couple years ago. I'm glad you're in a good spot. I'm like, oh yeah, man, I'm great. you know? Mm-hmm. I had people that come up to me and say, I'm where you are back in 2007 and 2008. That's where I'm at now. I'm like, okay, I can help you. So we are all on different journeys and on different legs of our journeys and our different moments of our journeys. We have to reach back and pick up those ones that are still behind our leg of the journey. And that's what I try to do every day.
Well, that's awesome. Cool. Can we talk a little bit about resilience? Because I know it's a topic that you advise, you coach people, you speak about. This is a show about risk and uncertainty and resilience. So, very, very curious around, how you define, how you look at resilience and, how people can start to practice resilience, becoming more resilient. It'd be cool to dive into that a little bit.
Yeah. So resilience is your ability to withstand, recover, and grow through every face of adversity, stressor, and changing demands in your life. The big risk is not being that resilient person and getting caught up like I did. I wasn't a resilient person, but resilience is a learned behavior. I love I teach mental, physical, spiritual, and social resilience skill sets. I love that. This is really what I'm passionate about. So your ability to withstand, recover, and grow. We put ourselves in situations that we either need to learn the lesson or we didn't learn it, and we keep on having to go through that same situation.
Sure.
The key is to live. That's the risk involved, right? If you don't learn from every situation that you're in, you will risk going back to that situation every single time. Yeah, and a lot of people do.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah. So you talked about different aspects there about resilience, and I'm, as a military man and somebody who, that sort of mental, physical, and the spiritual side. And just to, as an aside, I've got listeners who have all sorts of faiths and backgrounds. Yeah. So they they don't, but I'm curious, wonder if you could just break that down a little bit, the mental side, the physical side, the spiritual side. What are, to you, when you teach resilience, what do those things mean, or how do you teach people those things? How do you help them to look at them?
Yeah. So mental, mental is your mental toughness, your mental awareness, your mindfulness. I teach mindfulness skills too. 3 minutes of mindfulness. If you just close your eyes and you see, what are you seeing? Hear. What am I hearing? Am I hearing birds? Am I hearing the lights kind of echo through the room? What am I feeling? Right. So you do those mindfulness exercises. See, hear, and feel. Park bench. Sit on a park bench and listen. Watch people. Watch their movements. Watch their interactions. Sometimes we get so caught up in the negatives of our life, we never take the time to appreciate the beauty and excellence that is around us every single day. In nature, they say that nature walks. If you take a 20-minute nature walk, you are less likely to have depression. 20 minutes a day, nature walk, less likely to have depression. So we talk about the effects on your body of having mental toughness, mindfulness, physical. We talk about strength, endurance. So it's not just about working out, but it's knowing what we're putting in our bodies as far as food. We talk about nutrition, right? So we talk about your social communication, social connectedness, how you interact. I teach classes. Oh, there's a John Maxwell class. It's an awesome class. Everyone communicates, few connect. Love that class. So I teach an interpersonal problem solving and a good listening and active constructive responding class. Great relationship building class. It's awesome. So we talk about in a social setting, where you are, because we always long to belong, right?
Absolutely.
Always long to belong to something, a group, a friend. Some people with some people that don't have a lot of friends, they have one or two people that they are connected to, and that is their source. In a spiritual, we talk about a little bit of that social, but in spiritual, all spiritual resilience is your ability to strengthen a set of beliefs, principles, and values. That is what the spiritual is all about. Inside of that spiritual resilience, I talk about building your board of directors. It kind of goes into your social, but it's really spiritual. Your board of directors is a person, place, or thing that elevates you to success. I have a pastor that talks about your friends being like elevator buttons. They can take you up or they can bring you down. So you build yourself a board of directors. We each have areas of our lives that we need somebody to elevate us in. There are, I believe, five key areas. You know, you have your mental and social and spiritual. You have all that. But you also have your relationships. You have your finances or your wealth. You can have either one, finances and wealth. You have your professional. And then you have your self, your mind, your body, yourself. So, and other people have, let's say, parenting. That can be another area of their life. Religion, that can be another area of their life. But there's only about five key ones that we all have in common. So we build out board of directors for our lives because these are the person, the places, and the things that will elevate us. That will make us better and propel us into a 10X life. Every major company has a board meeting that they go to talk about growth. Every major CEO goes and has a board around their company to make sure that they are successful. So if that is true, why are we not building a board of directors to make us successful? Why are we not building a board of directors to ensure our own growth? And so I'll tell people to build yourself a board of directors for your life.
Very cool. And if you're just thinking back to your, you know, your experience, you had people around you that helped you. And if you put those things in place already, then if you go through, a hardship and, life has got hardships, right? So, I mean, that's almost guaranteed that we'll run into some kind of adversity. So it's just one of those things that helps you to overcome, whatever hardship. Speaking of those kinds of things, I mean, I think what I am interested in is, how can you test for how resilient you might be individually, just like an organization might test for how resilient they might be. If everything goes wrong in this quarter, or this product goes bust or whatever, we get a cyber attack or whatever, these organizations test that, right? Simulate those kinds of tests just to see how they're doing. And I think it'd be useful as individuals to do the same sort of thing, but without, throwing your money away or doing something that's going to, that's going to cause any permanent damage. But I think it'd be useful to think about, well, how can I test where I am on all these things? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, break it down. Your mental toughness, right? How mentally prepared are you? I teach a class called Balance Your Thinking. Balance Your Thinking has a core aspect where if you and someone else are fighting for a position, you're vying for this promotion, whatever, and you get out of a meeting, you get a handshake, you're like, oh, thank you, we'll be in touch. And then you see the person that you're competing against shaking and high-fiving, and you're like, yeah, you might think, oh, man, I didn't get the job, and oh, what's going on? And you know what I mean? It could be something completely related. We need to balance our thinking. So if you find yourself in a lot of negative thinking, and you know who you are, I mean, nobody knows you better than you. So you know if you're a negative person. If you're a negative person and you're always focusing on the negatives, then you're not there. A good way to get out of that is to count three blessings a day. So what I'm doing right now with a group is doing a 66-day challenge, because on the 66th and 67th day, you have officially formed your brain to form a habit.
Okay.
You didn't know that. Conditioned your brain, right? 66 day. So what we're doing is three times a day, count your blessings for 66 days, and you have 198 different blessings, things that you're thankful for. And so what happens
is— Does it have to
be
a different one every day?
Okay. Something like, you can't say, I love my house every single day.
Yeah, right.
So it's like, so today I was supposed to work. We just had to go into work for some things. I got a phone call saying, hey, man, you don't have to come to work. That's a blessing. You find $5 in your pants. That's a blessing.
Okay.
You connect with a long lost friend. You're like, oh, my gosh, a blessing, right? So just 198 different blessings. And I say different by, I like my shoes. I like my house. Like,
right.
We want to go deep. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Okay. So as far as your physical, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody knows that they're physically fit or not. If you could run a mile without collapsing, mm-hmm. I think that you're pretty physically fit. Mm-hmm. Now, if you run a mile in about 30 minutes, mm-hmm. not so much.
Yeah. Yeah.
So set targets for yourself. You know, run a mile in about 12 or 15 minutes. Just see how you feel. You know if you're in good physical condition or not. But if you're always drinking like pizza or drinking a soda and eating pizza mm-hmm. and you are, you know, I'd rather have donuts over some spinach or something. Mm-hmm. Then, I mean, you really need to assess, mm-hmm. you know,
yeah.
as far as social, if you don't have a good social, your net worth equals your network. Your network equals mm-hmm. your net worth. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if you are the average of the five people that you hang around the most. If you're hanging around drug dealers and convicts and you are the average, then mm-hmm. I mean, you are who you hang around. Mm-hmm. So my dream is to talk on the TED stage. I want to hang around with people that have been on the TED stage. I want to hang around very successful speakers and authors mm-hmm. because that's what I want to be.
Sure.
So that's your kind of your social, and then yeah. your spiritual is, do you have strong beliefs? Mm-hmm. Do you have a set of principles and values that you are always
right.
fighting for.
Right. Yeah. So it doesn't have to be, you know, you know, necessarily just Christian or Buddhist or whatever. Right. It's just a set of values that you know, you can,
right.
that you can believe in and, you know, whatever that, you know, the golden rule, whatever. Okay. Very, I think that's really sage stuff. And I really, so we kind of, got into you know, resilience a little bit, and I think skipped over, you know, you became this drill sergeant, and then you're given this wonderful advice that clearly, you know, you've been on a journey. So I'm just wondering if, you know, how that journey proceeded from, you know, sort of drill sergeant to coaching and training and all that stuff. We don't have to, you don't have to dive into every, you know, every single twist and turn, but it, you know, you've clearly, you know, went from a bottom to you know, much higher vibration. So I'm curious how that proceeded.
I went through my adversity, and I went through all of that. I became the drill instructor. I got from San Antonio, Texas to North Carolina mm-hmm. in 2013. And I was at an event on base, and I met a guy who said he's bringing up this resilience program in the military. And he's like, oh, you're a drill instructor? He's like, dude, I've got a job for you.
Right.
And so we talked. I loved what he had to say about the resilience part. Hmm. And I said, yeah, man, I'm in. I mean, I love training. I love teaching. Out of that tragedy that I went through, birthed the passion that I never even knew I had. Mm. I was going to go be a drill instructor because I just wanted to scream and yell at people because that's what my drill instructor did.
Right.
And I wanted to march people. Marching was my favorite thing. Mm. But what I found was those aha moments, mm-hmm. those moments where those trainees are going, aha, aha, I got it now. And you could, like, you impact so many people in that capacity. I mean, I've developed over 600 men and women into military leaders. I probably can't even talk to 600 people in, you know, 2 or 3 months or 4 months or whatever, you know, without being on like a stage. But in that setting, we grew together. They grew me as much as I grew them. You know, I became better each and every time. Every flight that I led through basic training, I became better. And I learned new skills, and I learned new tips and tricks. There's so much you can learn about people. And then when I became a resiliency trainer in 2013, I fell in love even more. I was like, wow, man, this is awesome. And I've spoken at high schools and I've spoken at, you know, different events or whatever, but not professionally, not like a business. So last year I said, you know what? I'm going to do it. I'm going to build a speaking business. I'm going to build, you know, my legacy is what I'm going to do. I'm going to build it. So I've been following Simon Sinek, Zig Ziglar, John Maxwell, Eric Thomas, Gary Vaynerchuk, Chris Lockhead, John Vroman, John Berghoff, Hal Elrod. I mean, I'm following all these people to see their journeys, you know, and I'm just like, man, this is like, I want to be on the TED stage. I set a goal for 5 years from now. So in 2021, I will have spoken on the TED stage within that 5-year period. I will have spoken on the TED stage.
That's awesome. Yeah, those are some real giants of you know, people in the sort of I don't know what you call it, self-help, or it's not, I don't really like that term, self-help. I don't know how you feel about it, but yeah, those are some real giants. In terms of the,
they're all on my board of directors too. You know, when I say build that board of directors, they're all on my board of directors because they influence me. Anything that influences,
that's right, yeah,
your worldview or influences your opinions or just elevates you to be better. They are on your board of directors, and all those guys, they may not know it, or maybe they do, but they're on my board of directors.
Yeah. I mean, if you feed yourself, you know, these good, it's just like feeding your body, right? If you feed yourself the right books, the right podcasts, the right, you know, whatever, the right programs, you start to, you know, you go on that sort of journey of perpetual growth, which is really, really important. In terms of the TED stage, How does that work? I guess you have to get nominated. Is that right? Is that how that normally works? My understanding is that somebody has to nominate you, and then whoever looks at it will decide, or I don't know. I'm not entirely sure, but do you know much about how that works?
Getting onto
the stage at a TED talk.
Well, so there's different ways. So I'm looking at like TEDx events.
Yeah.
And I basically look up whatever, like the TEDx events that are coming around my area, and I look at the themes.
Yeah.
So if it goes with what I do, because I want to provide the most value that I can.
Right.
This is a dream of mine. So I'm really particular about what themes that I'm going to speak at.
Mm-hmm.
So most TED events will have a theme, broken chains, past pain, overcoming, business 101, whatever it may be.
Okay, got it.
So I look for the TED events that are within my niche, and I apply to those. And you can apply right on the websites.
Okay.
Or just email the coordinator, the event coordinator, say, hey, how do I apply? He'll send you a packet, or he'll say, hey, answer these questions. Yep. And then bio, headshot, you know, all that stuff.
Cool, got it. I hope you make it. I'm looking. I'll be following, and I'll certainly watch your talk. Let's talk about decision making, because you've come out very recently with a book on decision making, and I wanted to explore that a little bit. What led you to write a book, and what is it about decision making that what inspired you to write a book, precisely about decision making?
So back in January and February, I was having a real hard time sleeping. I couldn't figure out why. I was facing a decision, but I was like, man, I don't know. And I'm racking my brain. You ever get that way? We're like, man, I've got this.
Oh yeah.
I'm gonna have to sleep on it. I can't make a decision right now. This is huge. You know, marriage, kids, you know, big decisions. So I'm like, man, I really want to build a speaker business, but I'm having a blockage. I don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. I go to sleep. I wake up middle of the night, like in a panic attack. It was so weird. It was like a panic attack, and I had floods of emotions and thoughts. And I'm like, why am I thinking about when I was in third grade and I was moving? Why am I thinking about my grandparents? Like, I'm living in my grandparents' basement. What am I doing? And then I'm having these thoughts and these feelings and this out of control moment, you know, my wife wakes up and kind of calms me down, you know? And I was like, oh my gosh, that was like really weird. And so I'm writing all this stuff. I go back to sleep. A couple days later, same exact thing happens. Like, what is going on? I can't breathe. It feels like someone's standing on my chest. I'm like, oh my gosh. I'm like freaking out, literally freaking out. So like a week later, same thing happens. I'm like, oh my gosh. Like, I'm thinking about going to the doctor. I got like sleep apnea. Like, I'm freaking out. I can't sleep. I'm paranoid to sleep now. But I eventually made the decision that I needed to make. I look a couple days later at everything that I'd written down. I had so many thoughts on paper, and I was reading them all, and I'm like, wow. So then I wrote a table of contents, and then eventually I had a book. I just expanded on all these thoughts, and every thought that I had and every emotion that I had and everything that I was experiencing, I put it on paper, and by the time I knew it, I had a book already written. So it was almost like my past experiences. It was so, oh my gosh, it was so weird. And I literally believe it was the work of God making me write this book. I firmly believe that. I don't care what anybody else says. That is my belief. But it was so weird that I woke up and I was like, why am I thinking about my fourth grade, you know, time where my stepdad was arrested? Why am I thinking about my time in the military in the middle of the desert? Like, why am I, oh my gosh. And all these thoughts started coming to me. And then, you know, eventually I made a decision, but it's about self-defeating behaviors. Okay. We self-talk ourselves out of dreams. We defeat ourselves before we even begin. We don't make decisions. We're undecisive. That's a self-defeating behaviors. We all have self-defeating behaviors. Inability to communicate, your alcohol and drug use, all self-defeating behaviors. And I write about it in this book. And I tell you exactly the power to overcome these self-defeating behaviors.
Okay. And so it's about decision-making and overcoming these. I mean, okay, so I guess it'd be good to talk a little bit about self-defeating behaviors and how to overcome them. And I don't want to give away, we're not going to, you know, get you to read your book, and we don't have time for that anyway, so people can check out the book. But but just in terms of, you know, let I don't know if you think about an example or, you know, because I think we all have, we all have self-defeating behaviors. I mean, the most, some of the most successful people in the world have them, right? And that's probably just, you know, part of being a human being. But you know, what's your experience been, and how do you overcome them?
Okay. So one of the most common self-defeating behaviors, people talk about fear being like, oh, you have to overcome your fear. You have to overcome your, but it's more than that. You always have to ask yourself a series of questions. Why? Why are you afraid of that? And there's always a why. Fear is just an overlying. I'm probably making so many psychotherapists mad right now.
That's all right.
Fear,
yeah,
is there's a why attached to that.
Yeah,
alcoholism, there's a why attached to that. These self-defeating behaviors that we have, the most common one that we all possess is the approval that we have to have from other people. Like, why do I care about that? Well, because I want to be liked. I long to belong. All of the self-defeating behaviors are rooted, deep-rooted in that long to belong. You know, dogs are pack animals. I believe humans are pack animals, you know? So we're also creatures of habit, which is the second most common self-defeating behavior. We had bad habits. And we do what's comfortable rather than getting out of our comfort zone and stepping into something that is uncomfortable for us. Because when you do that, you will unlock hidden talents and abilities that you never existed. And that's what happened with me. So the biggest one, though, is that long to belong. We will do things to be accepted by other people. We want to provide value to people. We want to do good in the world. But we defeat ourselves because, oh, well, they don't like me, so I'm just not going to do it. Or, you know, everybody's going over here and I don't believe it, but I'm just going to do it anyways because I don't want to be left behind. You know what I mean? I'm always picked kickball last. I'm always picked last for, you know what I mean? It's always kickball. I don't know why it's kickball, but it's always kickball. So, you know, so, but I know people who were kicked last or picked last, you know, for kickball, but oh my God, they're amazing. They're amazing people and they're caring people, you know? So alcoholism, drugs, those are self-defeating behaviors. Anything we exhibit negative is self-defeating behaviors. Here's how you overcome those. Forget about everything you know for a second. Pretend like you don't know anything about social connectedness. You don't know anything about the world. You know, it's kind of like those 1 and 2 year old babies that are are around. Okay, here's the thing. It does not matter what other people think about you. It only matters how you feel about yourself. That's self-esteem. That's the deep root of everything positive that happens to us is your self-esteem. Do you or do you not care about yourself? And when you don't care about yourself, then all these self-defeating behaviors start to pop up. I self-talk. I suck. I can't do this. I'm no good. Because you don't have self-esteem. Self-esteem is the foundation of everybody. That's why it's called self-esteem, right? So all these pillars shoot out of the ground. I have self-esteem. I have a positive mindset. Boom. there's your pillar. There's your positive mindset, your mindfulness, right? Well, man, I feel good. Boom, there's your physical. All of a sudden, you've got another leg to stand on. I've got physical fitness. I've got mental fitness, right? Then when you feel good about yourself, you can provide value. Then you start to feel a sense of self-worth. Boom, there's your social pillar. And that pillar starts shooting out of the ground. Now you've got all these different things that are popping up. And then you have a set of beliefs and principles and values and morals that you have that is unshaken. Boom, there goes your spiritual pillar. So all these pillars start rooting out of the ground. It all starts with your self-esteem. How do you feel about yourself? I guarantee you someone right now is like, yeah, I really don't have a lot of self-esteem. I don't. I'm not a real positive person in that. But why? Why is that? As soon as you figure out what the why, mine was my physical abuse from my ex-stepdad. My mom divorced him finally, and we moved on. But it was rooted there because I didn't feel like I mattered. Never felt like I mattered. I went through high school. I graduated with like a 2.0 or 1.9. I was like, I don't care about high school. I don't care about college. I don't care about nothing. You know, started drinking at a young age, you know, when I was 19. Started drinking because when you're in the military and you're overseas in the UK, you know, my first base was in Lakenheath, England, RAF Lakenheath. It's my first base. I got plastered every day. And I loved that feeling of I could just whisk my sorrows away in a bottle, not deal with anything. And I could be who I want to be behind the bottle. So how you overcome these is having a positive mindset. It always starts with your mindset. And you have to win the morning. Start it out, positive note, and count blessings every day. You focus on negative so many times, count your blessings. Focus on the positives and just throw the negatives aside.
Okay. In terms of, I mean, I guess what I fully agree with you. I do think though that it's it beyond the mindset, then it's becomes a practice. So there's mindset and action that need to go together. Just thinking positively is good, but if you sort of, I wish that this was different isn't really, I mean, it's not the same thing, right? That's not really positive thinking. That's just wishful thinking. So there's, I guess there's, there's more to it than just, just thinking positively, I suppose. It's a necessary but not sufficient condition. Okay. Very, that's really good stuff. So in terms of decision making, what is, I mean, when someone is approaching, say, a difficult decision, I don't know whether or not to change careers or to change their relationship or do something different or to start a, like you did, like start a new business or, whatever. How should people start to think about those difficult decisions?
So one of the things that I find fascinating, is the decision to start. Some people don't even make that decision. Like, what is holding you back? Let me tell you this. You have 100% success rate at anything you will do. If you harness the potential and you follow what other successful people are doing, you have 100% success rate. Now, you also have 100% success rate at failure. People who say they can and people who say they can't are both right. So if I say, I really want to do this, I'm going to take action. That is how you overcome that decision. Somebody is faced with a monumental decision like, oh my God, should I do it? Should I not do it? What are the pros and cons? I don't know what to do. And sometimes you just say, yes, and figure it out later. Just do that. Just yes, and just figure the rest out later. Because what you've done is you've made a decision. And once you make the decision, everything else will come fairly easy. The first part is, we get hung up. I don't make the wrong decision. Oh my gosh, I don't want to make the wrong decision. What do I do? Oh my gosh. And you just don't make the decision. And then finally, I did that on a speaking gig one time. I was like, oh my God, I really want to speak here, but I don't know if I'm the right speaker. I mean, I kind of know what they're talking about, but I don't know. And then gone. I was like, and I missed out.
I think that's a really profound, profound point and way of looking at it because, the decision is actually you could make lots of decisions and they'd be they'd probably work out fine, but but when you actually people are making decisions with kind of incomplete information anyway, So we don't know what it's going to be like. Like I started a podcast 8 months ago. I didn't really know what that's going to be like. As you say, just taking some action, then you get more information, more feedback, and you can start to move closer to whatever it is that you're trying to do versus, let's wait until everything's perfect and then we'll start. Well, by that time, you'll probably be dead. I need to have enough money. I need to have,
she's got
to
start.
Yeah, exactly. I need, my relationships to be in this condition. I need to get, whatever.
Right.
And then you'll never get there. So I think that's really profound. I'm an analytical person. So I think a lot about, pros and cons and stuff like that. So I've been in that trap where it's just wait. And then you actually end up paralyzing yourself because you don't move forward. And I think it's really important to, just action in a particular direction. And unless it's something that is if the consequences are so negative that they're irreversible, okay, jumping off a cliff or whatever. But beyond that, right. Just take a step in the direction you want to go and see how that feels.
Yeah. And just remember that you're free to make any decisions you want to, but you're not free from the consequences of those decisions.
Sure,
because every decision, there's not one. I don't care who you are. There is not one decision that you will ever make that it will not affect at least one person in your life. I guarantee. I don't care if you are an only child, you have no parents, no grandparents, like you are the only one on this planet. I guarantee you someone knows you, someone cares about you, and the decision that you make will never ever only impact you. I mean, unless you're eating a bowl of cereal, but that's not the decisions that I'm talking about. What cereal do I eat? No, I'm talking about the monumental decisions.
Sure.
It will always impact somebody else.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean that's really profound stuff, and again, I don't know about you, but I do struggle from time to time with that. That's sort of overthinking it, and I think a lot of people do. The other side of that is it becomes an excuse, right? It becomes easy to procrastinate.
Yeah.
So.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. No, action is really really important to take. Action into the direction that you want to go. So that's a very good advice. Do you have any thoughts on this whole thing of decision fatigue? Have you come across that term, where we've got so much information coming at us that we have to make so many decisions about little things that when it comes to the big things we've used up all our all our cognitive resources, and I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Any thoughts on
decision fatigue? So this is this concept of, we have so many stimuli and so many things that are being thrown at us, what to have for breakfast, what to wear, what to, whether or not to respond to, this email. And if we spend so much time on those little decisions, then when it comes to thinking about the big decisions, we're already exhausted. So I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Okay. So what I tell people, is don't be afraid of any decision. Mm-hmm. But if, let's say you're working towards a goal, you have this ginormous goal. Mm-hmm. Okay. You have to write out a plan, and you have to plan those decisions. So one of the ones is like, what are you doing today? What are you doing tomorrow? Mm-hmm. And what are you doing like next week? Mm-hmm. What are you doing in a couple of days? What are you doing in a couple of months? So you have to write out a plan for those decisions, because those decisions will come.
Yeah.
Right. So it's easy when you're making decisions, it's easy to put everything into context of like a roadmap for your life. Mm-hmm. Okay. I know I want to do this by this time. I know I want to do this by this time. So I know in the next 5 years, I want to talk on the 10th stage. It's not an option. I will do it. Mm-hmm. When me and the wife were getting married, it was like, well, when do we get married? Oh, well, what about this time? Oh, and that's what most people do, right? Mm-hmm. They're like, well, when do you want to have kids? Oh, when should we do this? I don't know. They never set a plan, set a roadmap, plan everything. Like I know this lady that I met at this conference, she calls herself a lifestyle architect. I'm like, oh, I love that. Love that. Yeah. You have to have a strategy for your life.
Mm.
Mm. I'm not saying you gotta be OCD about it.
Yeah.
But you gotta set those goals and plans. And,
sure.
Right? So what you do is, you know, you say, what am I doing today? What am I doing, you know, tomorrow? Whatever your short-term ones, and then you have long-term ones. What am I doing in the next few days? What am I doing in the next few weeks? What am I doing in the next few months? And just plan stuff, you know, and plan to fail too. Definitely plan to fail because you're going to hit obstacles.
Yes.
But if you don't make those decisions and you don't plan those decisions, then you're already stuck. You're already going to fail.
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. Very, very cool and a very profound, powerful stuff, really, that, that, you know, it's really useful to think about and reflect on. And we get really lazy, right? We don't think about this stuff in our lives. I want to be respectful of your time, but just in terms of what's next for you, and you know, you've got this book and you have this this goal to become a TED speaker. Your longer term vision for what it is you're trying to do. I'm curious what that is, what that looks like.
Well, I've got 5 more years left in the military, and I retired from active duty Air Force.
Okay.
You know, so I'm still in.
Yes.
Yeah, I got four more years.
Okay. We didn't clarify that, but yeah, I think that's that was useful to do that. So you're doing all this stuff on the side, right?
I'm actually doing it all on the side. Like, so I go to work, you know, Monday through Friday, I go to work.
Yeah.
But like after work, sometimes I'll drive, you know, like an hour away and go speak somewhere.
Okay.
Or I'll do like a book signing or, you know, I got out of work and then I drove 3 hours south to Charlotte and I spoke in Charlotte.
Okay.
You know, so I love, it's my passion. It's my purpose.
Yeah.
I found my purpose out of tragedy, and out of tragedy births a passion that you never even existed, that you never even knew that you had.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I love doing it. And I'm building a base and I'm building this business now so that in 4 or 5 years, when I get out of the military, I'm not just stuck like, okay, what do I do now?
Yeah.
What do I do now? You know what I'm saying? So
that's great.
My long term, I'm going to be speaking and coaching and training, and I'm going to be doing that stuff, you know, forever, you know, until I literally can't talk anymore. People just get sick of me.
Sure.
That's the way that I coach people, is that same way. What are you doing today? Mm-hmm. You have a dream, and what are you doing today?
Mm-hmm.
What are you doing tomorrow?
Mm-hmm.
And all these little tomorrows add up to a couple of days, a couple of weeks, a couple of months. And then finally you've got a goal that you've achieved.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I coach people. But yeah, I'd love to get my message spread across the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I'd love to speak in different countries.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to be famous, you know, like Tony Robbins, and like, yeah, I want to be kind of a household name, whatever, but I don't want to be famous just to be famous.
Mm-hmm.
I want to be known as, this guy helped me. At the end of my life, I want someone to say, because of you, I did not give up. You inspired me to be better than I was yesterday. That's the legacy that I want to leave behind.
Very cool. Yeah. If you can, you know, think about people that are coming up to you that you didn't even know, or that you hardly, and then they tell you, well, you had this profound impact. I think that's beautiful. That's definitely a great purpose, to have. As I said, I want to be respectful of your time, and we've gone for a little over an hour here, but is there anything that we didn't cover that you would like to mention or talk about? Or
I've had a lot of fun.
Cool. Likewise. Yeah, this has been great.
A lot of fun.
You know, for people that really that really enjoyed this and want to know more about you, where they can, you know, find you on the internet and social media, what are some of the best places to do that? By the way, I'll put it all in the show
notes. Absolutely. I mean, you can look on facebook.com/ Sean, S-E-A-N, Sean Douglas Speaks. And that's my Facebook page. I also have a LinkedIn profile, and I got a website. So if you go to Facebook and you hit the Book Now button, it'll take you right to my website.
Cool.
And I'd love to connect with people and love to know more about them. And hit me up anytime.
Yeah.
Love to talk, love to chat, see how I can help you succeed in life.
Cool. This has been awesome, Sean. I really appreciate you coming on.
Likewise.
And you know, all the best, and you know, continued success.
You too. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. I hope you guys enjoyed that and that you found it interesting and useful. As always, check out the show notes. You can learn how to connect with Sean, and we will look out for him on the TED stage. As I mentioned in the intro, I'm going to be doing a couple of best of episodes, and there are now 31 full episodes of the podcast up and counting. There'll be a few more before the year is up. I'd like to hear from you around what some of your favorites were and what some of the sections or portions of those episodes were so that I can include them. I've got my own ideas, but I'd love to hear from you. allthingsrisk@gmail.com. Once again, the best place to do that. Check out allthingsrisk.co.uk. You can find all the ways in which you can subscribe to the show. We will be back in 2 weeks' time. I know I did start the fall season, if you like, by saying that we will be posting episodes once every 2 weeks, and with exception, we'll have an episode in between those weeks. And for the most part, we've had episodes in between those weeks because I've had so many wonderful conversations that I've just had to get them out. However, I think that it'd be good to take a bit of a pause next week. So that's what we'll do. You can check out any of the episodes that you may have missed, but we will be back in a couple of weeks with another great conversation. Some great conversations to end the year with. So please stay tuned for that. In the interim, don't forget, risk is life.